This is Carl the Jackal Frampton.
Hi, this is David Healy.
Hello, this is Stephen Ferris.
Hi, I'm Bethany Ferris.
Hi, this is Joey Barton.
I'm Jonas Gutierrez.
Hi, this is Harry Kuehl.
And you're listening to The Score.
The Score with Michael Clark.
And welcome along to The Score with me, Michael Clark. And on this week's show, we are doing something very special. We have a studio guest in with us. He is an Irish League legend. He made a career scoring goals, and very important ones too. Plenty of silverware picked up along the way. And now his goals have changed. He is inspiring the next generation. He is Andy Waterworth.
The Score with Michael Clark.
Thank you, Michael. That was a great intro. I appreciate that. You made me sound better than I could ever imagine.
No, well, all the accolades and more, I'm sure, that will come during this interview, absolutely befitting you, sir. What an exciting week or so it's been for you. Bring us up to speed, what you're doing at the moment and what's been going on in the last week.
Yeah, well, look, firstly, my role at the Irish Football Association is head of elite player development, which I think in simplest terms is overseeing our talent system, our next generation players. And recently, as you alluded to, we've just returned from Italy, European qualification. We played three games out there. We unfortunately just missed out on automatic qualification. Italy, believe it or not, how big a nation they are, they just pipped us on goals scored. But it leaves us in a nice situation where we're the top five of the 14 groups, third place, best teams will qualify. So we're currently at four. So we're hoping that within the next couple of games, next couple of groups, that nobody pips us for that, and we can then go and compete in the elite rounds. And this will be for the second year in a row, which is great for our young players, and also our under-19s last year with Jared Little qualified for the elite rounds also, and next year's actual competition is held in Northern Ireland. So it's some short wins for us, some positives. We had to give you some context for the under-17 recent squad, we had seven players who can play again next year, and most of the players have come through our domestic pathway here. So some good times and some high potential players coming through.
And what a start for you and your young team as well. You look at the last couple of games, a comprehensive win over San Marino and a draw with Italy. Now, any time, any level going in against Italy, there's an expectation there. They are huge, huge favourites. What's it like to get a draw against them and to be able to say that that's something you and your team have achieved?
Absolutely. We were delighted to have a defensive masterclass against the team who are stereotypically defensive masterclass team in their own backyard was great. But I think from a coaching point of view, the thing that pleased me the most was the other nations had a lot of friendly games to prepare for this. We didn't, just given the nature of where we're at. And we had one day to prepare for the game, and it was to the players' credit, every single detail was taken on board, and the players were excellent. I don't think they could quite believe, how resolute and how informed we were as a team. And then just like the first game, Greece beat us 2-0. It was a very open game. We had quite a lot of possession of the ball. Just couldn't find the end product. And as you said there, Michael, comprehensively beating San Marino, we needed, if we got a goal disallowed, actually, that would have brought us through to win 5-0. And when you reflect and you watch the game back, it shouldn't have been disallowed. Like, I don't want to come on here and a hard luck story, because at the end of the day, it's all around player development. The score, the results sometimes are tangible, short term things that we can show the players it's working. But look, there's great learning from it. It's another tournament that our young players are exposed to, and look, hopefully, come the end of this month, that we're in another elite rounds, and we'll look forward to that.
And what we're doing at the moment is literally just waiting for all the other groups to finish to see how things fall.
Yeah, we're hoping there's no other big results from we're a third place seeded team in our group, so we're hoping that no other third place teams are probably beaten top seed. And if that doesn't happen, we'll find ourselves in the elite rounds. But look, if it does, it just wasn't meant to be, and we'll dust ourselves down and look forward to next year's qualifying campaign.
Well, it's nice to have positive news around the underage setup, because the senior team is obviously going through a difficult period at the moment. I wonder how you reflect on that with your players who obviously want to be senior internationals one day themselves.
Look, we talk quite a lot about it. I mean, that is ultimately what our staff will be judged on, is creating future internationals, or, you know, not even creating them, supporting them, because the research tells you it's 10% around coaching. It's more around environment and individual player development and people's desire to be international footballers. And look, the good thing from our point of view, look, I suppose the road to Damascus is always the start. So the start is that we understand where we're at. There's a long way to go. We need to start, you know, producing more young players, but we can only control what we can control. And at this minute in time, we have got a lot of talent there. We've got a lot of young players who want to play for Northern Ireland, and if they can continue on this trajectory of their journey, then one day they'll be senior international footballers. And you only have to look at the recent examples of Callum Marshall, you know, Dale Taylor, Brody Spencer, who have come through in such a short space of time into the senior international team. Shea Charles, Isaac Price, who have come through our eligibility pathway. And then not to mention, a lot of the young players are now playing 21s and under 19s as well. So some positives, we're not getting carried away. We have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. We understand as a nation at the minute where we're at. But, you know, it's a challenge, and there is some real high potential, some good potential players who are, you know, wearing the green jersey at youth international level.
So what is it for you that, you know, needs to happen to make it even easier, to make us more successful? You want to find the best players. Is that further exploring or exploiting eligibility options? Or is there something we can do to actually get more homegrown players to the point where they can be more successful than previous generations could do?
Look, it's a great question. It's the million-dollar question that we ask ourselves every single day. For a start, we don't even work. I mention the word pathway quite a lot. I'm reluctant to even use that word. It's probably more a talent system, because mm-hmm. there's no one-size-fits-all journey. It's a bit of everything, what you've said. We have a lot of players who are born in England but are Northern Irish, who have a mother, father, granny, granda who are from Northern Ireland. We have players who are late developers in Northern Ireland who are come through their journey late on, Conor McMenamin, Trey Hume, etc. There's players who leave really, really early who are just ready to go into Category 1 Academy football in England. So it's all of the above. What we have to try and do is be flexible as a nation and try and support, along with our clubs. We try and prioritise, you know, we try and get very personal with players and advise them on where we think their journey could be best. So it's all of the above, and we have a very cohesive coaching staff, right from Michael down to ourselves within the academy, and trying to sustain. If we can sustain players' careers in the game, it gives our international managers, you know, more of a pool of players to pick from. So it's very much long term thinking. Can we give them the tools to not just cope with the game on the pitch, but also mostly off the pitch, you know, so they're not homesick, so they can be exposed to what they're going to face early doors. So when it does become, maybe they've been released from a League One club, whatever, and they understand that and they're ready for it, and they still remain in the game. So all of the above.
We're going to be talking about Andy's playing career during this conversation. It's really lovely to have you for this time on the programme this week. So for big Linfield fans in particular, yes, that will come up. Just the coaching side clearly is where you're at this point in your life, and it's a really, really interesting area to sort of try and understand late developers as a concept. frustrating. Nobody wants to be a late developer. Everyone just wants to be naturally perfect from day one. That's not a reality. You know, what do you do with that? Because what I'm mindful of is coaches, people. We put people into little categories, and nearly, if you don't see a potential early, you could be discarded and that talent could actually be missed out on.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on late developers and how you make sure that just because somebody isn't right now doesn't mean that they're not right later on?
Yeah, look, we believe it or not, there's concept, there's research out there, and they call them silver medalists. You know, people who aren't always in the managers or coaches thinking early doors and end up going the longer way.
Mm-hmm.
I think even the makeup of our senior international team, late developers, has been a theme. It's been a very successful mode of transport of players for us. We're all for it. We don't get too caught up in players doing things too early. Something we have in Northern Ireland within the product of the Irish League is such a good development league for players who maybe aren't ready. Because I suppose I'm trying to give the context here. It's not like England or Scotland where we have a full-time professional league, full-time professional academy set up. So if you're in Northern Ireland, if you want to go to an academy at post-16, once you've left legal education, you have to get on a plane and move. And for some young players, that's quite hard, depending on where they're at and their maturity. So what we're saying is if you're not ready to undertake that challenge early doors, that is fine. You know, stay, play your football here in Northern Ireland. If you still have aspirations and desire to be a footballer, and we will support you, your club will support you, and eventually you'll get across if you have the technical ability and you have mostly the desire to be a footballer. So that's how we support them. We build rapport with players. Our elite player development program, used to be called Club NI, was set up to give players extra technical game time, extra technical practice time, so that they weren't missing out on their English, Scottish counterparts. So we've put processes in place, and we just hope that, you know, those people who don't get away don't get too disillusioned, and they stay within the game, and what they will know is that they'll probably end up to the place they want to go quicker from maybe the Irish League. And the good thing about it is we have role models now, so the Conor McManamans, the Trey Humes, you know, PKs, Paddy Kellys, all those types of players. Myself, I was one of those players who went across late. And when we speak to some young players now, they tell us, oh, my journey is actually, I'm going to stay here longer, and I'm going to be a PK, or I'm going to be a Conor McManaman, and that's my journey.
Mm-hmm.
Some lads are saying early doors, no, I want to go to this club here. I want to have the Craig Cathcart route, the Johnny Evans, the Sammy Klingham, the Steve David. I want to go over as early as possible, and that is fine. So ultimately, we just try and nurture them, and ensure that we're not forgetting players. With that as well, I do know we face some criticism. Naturally, you will miss some players. It's part and parcel. I don't think it can be a criticism. It's just that some players do develop in different ways, and we just have to make sure that we're in a position where we can embrace that also. But I think that as much as possible, if we can have a collaboration between, you know, club, national setup, and potential club, then it makes, you know, everyone's a winner.
You see, for that decision to make the move, how much of it is based on their personality? You know, do you nearly have to look at the entire individual and say, look, you might be very talented, but we don't think you're ready to cope with what it means to go to that place at this time?
Yeah, look, we have honest conversation with our players, with, you know, their parent guardians, and at this day and age sometimes with their agent, and we try and give them as much information. What we say is, like, our job is to try and ensure you have a sustainable career in the game if that's what you want. So we're always going to try and give you the best advice coming from the best possible place. We might not always get it right, but our position is that we want what's best for you. We can't speak about any individual cases naturally, because there's, you know, there's a safeguarding and a personal interest there. But what we say is, they're young players, is, yeah, look, it's important that when you do speak to a potential club, if you're going to leave your club in Northern Ireland, that they have a plan for you, that they are showing you how they're going to develop you and where they see you in 2 years, 3 years, and that they are fully, you know, bought into who you are and what you are, and then what they're going to do to mitigate against things like, you know, your homesickness, or mitigate against issues that could come up. And quite often, once a club can construct that or present that, we're fully behind it. And what we do is then to follow up is we have a lot of times where youth national coaches will go over and visit them in their environment. We have a welfare officer who works domestically in Northern Ireland with our players and ensures that their schooling is all their schoolwork's handed in, ensure that there's a balance between football or football training, because we do ask quite a lot of the young players in the elite programme from early stage. Now we also have a transition welfare manager, so for those players who do make that transition into England, Scotland, that Jim Grattan's our welfare transition manager, that he goes and visits them and ensures that all the resource and all the work that we're doing here isn't just done here, that it's actually followed up when they are in England or Scotland or hopefully in years to come continental Europe.
It's interesting to hear that, because I would imagine there's a lot of people who just presume you go, you play for your team, you get called up, you play a few matches, maybe you get a move, and they don't realise there's this whole machine in the background of it all.
We try and make sure it is in the background. We don't want to it's a constant machine working. Yeah, it's a good way to put it, because we understand the context of Northern Ireland. We know we have to go a little bit further than other national governing bodies in terms of our player development, but sometimes could be seen as stepping on the toes of our clubs. That's not our intention, and we just realised that because we have no professional academy set up here as of yet, that if we want our players to be playing senior international football, they need to be in the higher end of the game and some of the other professional leagues.
That in itself is a potentially quite interesting relationship. Some teams are now starting to do that or in a position where they have that already. Does that mean flexibility in time with the IFA will be required in terms of what age groups you look after and clubs look after?
Yeah, it's always evolution, not revolution. We reflect on our programme constantly. I mean, we have a residential academy because Jim McGilton at the time sought research from UEFA that we needed to have something to replicate what was happening in England. But, you know, once in 4 years' time, we might have a different system. We might have a different reality. And it might have to be, you know, where the clubs will have their own academy full-time set up and we step back and then we support elsewhere. Absolutely, we're really open to the evolution aspect. And we constantly review. We have a technical team. You know, we'll meet regularly. You know, Michael, who's our boss of football, basically, and Aaron Hughes and myself, you know, and the youth international coaches, we meet and we assess it constantly and just see how we can then maybe shift and work in 2 year cycles, 3 year cycles. And I suppose there's a strategic element where we work in 3-4 year cycles, but there's also a player development element where we try and not look too far ahead of 6 weeks, because there's so much change with young players even through a 6 week period. And to bring that to, I'll give you the reality, the under 17 team that we had recently last week that done ever so well. They say 13 of those guys were with us last year who had left and signed for full-time clubs in England. We've seen so much change from them already, physically, their height, their maturity, just from living away from home. So we can't look too far ahead of 6 weeks. We have to be patient with the young players, which we are. We can't get too emotional about it. And, you know, if we have a bad result, we can't go, oh, gee, this is the whole thing isn't working. We have to just be really, really, you know, disciplined and coordinated and cohesive with our thinking.
How have you found your transition into coaching and management? It seems to be something that you're really relishing.
Look, I love it. As I spoke to you off air, Michael, and we had a very similar conversation, I realised quite early that, you know, I wasn't going to be a top senior international footballer, and for reasons that I regret, and I wanted to always work in the game. So from the minute I came home from professional football in Scotland, I went to university and I started the journey of my coaching badges. I coached, I volunteered, and I knew that elite sport was where I wanted to be. So when the time came that, you know, I worked my way through the RSFA and the time came for this role, I felt I was ready. I had worked under Jim Jilton in the elite programme. I had worked as a coach educator. And it was something, I suppose, for your own country as well, that there's an emotional attachment and there is something in my stomach that I wanted to do. So I made sure I was ready for it. I suppose you can never be too ready for a role like this. But I prepared as much as I could be. And I'm really enjoying it. I can see it can be quite frustrating. It can be tiresome because I don't think you have any day off.
Even today, we're sitting here, and mine's not a woe is me because I'm just back from a lovely holiday. If you listened to last week's programme, that was recorded ahead of time to allow me to go to New York. But I haven't even touched down 24 hours yet, I don't think. You've just come back from Zurich, and you're going to jet off again very soon. So it is relentless.
It is. I think, funny, I spoke to, you know, two people in football recently around, you know, managing and balancing my time. And they said, look, unfortunately with football, you're either in it or you aren't. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's where I'm at. I mean, I'm not looking for sympathy because I love it. I'm in a great job. But you don't switch off. I'm even having breakfast this morning and I'm thinking about a decision I made out in camp, and can that player play left centre half? And I'm going to bed at night. Are we getting this right? Are we getting it wrong? Do we need to do this? Do we change this? Part of the programme is other countries getting a foot up on us, and you're just constantly, because you feel responsible, and with that responsibility, because it's football, there's nobody who works in football that can just sort of quell their passion. So there's also that passion element. And look, you talk about the highs and lows, it makes it all worthwhile. When I stood in Italy last week and we just had a real mammoth result, 0-0 against Italy in their backyard, and the players that did it were players you've worked with for the last 6-7 years, it makes it all worthwhile. Or when you see the Callum Marshall or whoever stepping onto a pitch, mm-hmm. making a senior international appearance, or you know, you see coaches who have done it, it does make it all worthwhile, and there are the times where you can reflect and have a smile. But look, I love the role. I'm very lucky that I work with people like Aaron Hughes as well, who are really good, really supportive. Somebody who's come from such a high standard.
I'm not trying to embarrass you because he's a colleague now, but you know, what's that initially like when you start working with these people that, you know, you've looked up to, senior international footballers like Aaron Hughes, model professional, and you're now going to him for advice, and there's probably part of you, maybe there isn't, in your brain going, I hope these ideas aren't stupid to him because he's been there and done it.
If Emily knows Aaron, he's very humble. He always makes sense. He doesn't need to be front and centre. He doesn't rush into any sort of decision. He's quite deep, reserved, takes a back seat, and then usually comes up with a real sensible answer. And for him, he gets it. I think he's the right person that we have at the minute. He'll always be really supportive. His detail is top drawer. I mean, if he watches every training that we put all our training sessions on our Huddle account, and he'll watch every training session. He'll break down detail if a passing session isn't right and isn't sort of fit of player development. They'll break it down. He'll want to debrief and in a real constructive way. So the small details to him means a lot. And what he has taught me is the high standards, the high accountability of high level football. So he's always available, and like myself, he has that passion element too. So he's great. I was very fortunate. Gareth McCauley's in the pathway too. I worked with Ger Little the last couple of years, and you know, it was great for me. And Chris Lindsay's in there, so a lot of really good people we're all quite different. Mm-hmm. And when it comes together, I think we have the nation's best interest at heart, but we also have player development, you know, at heart as well.
How would you describe your coaching style? I'm sure it's still evolving because you're young in your own career in terms of that. But you know, if you had to try and find a couple of words to say, this is how I want to do it.
Methodical, personal, outcome driven. So my role at the minute, I'll always ensure, because my job is more longer term about players, I'll always make sure that I'm doing something that actually has the development aspect of the player, mm-hmm. At the best interest. I like to work. I get a lot of stick from the other coaches. I like to work very slow and detailed, like a tactical session. And I think it comes from my coach education background, where I used to deliver coach education sessions. So mightn't be player orientated all the time. And that's what Chris Lindsay's good at. He's very much a player orientated coach, real high energy sessions. I like the tactical element, where I'm maybe prepping for Italy, so we'll go through very slowly and what they will do, and give some insight as to what, and examples of what we're going to do, and then working real clear, this is your priority order, so if they do this is what I want you to do. what happens if they do this? So that's my coaching style, and I think that's why myself and Chris at the younger ages work well, because then he'll have to maybe pick up the pieces, get the players energised and driven. So that's my coaching style. I like to educate as I coach.
It's really, really interesting just hearing that, and that's why you need to have the right people around you, because you all bring different pieces to the puzzle, and hopefully you get a complete picture at the end of it.
Yeah, that's it, and that's what a coaching team, and like, I'm no expert in coaching really, or I'm sure if you ask most managers, you know, I'm sure if you're asking David Healy or Owen Kearney, you know, Tiernan Lynch tomorrow, they'll tell you probably a little bit more detail and insight, but I'm sure the theme's the same, where they bring people around who they can trust. And the best bit of advice I got from Andy McMoran, an old schoolboy international coach, he said to me, always bring somebody in who's better than you. Always bring people in around you who are better than you, and I've always tried to stick to that.
It's a good bit of advice as well, and that can be difficult with people, because one of the biggest obstructions in anyone's path can be your own ego, and if you're, you know, around people and view everyone as a threat instead of thinking, no, I need to challenge myself, I need to be better, then you don't go too far, do you?
Michael, that's a great point, and that's one thing that we work quite a lot with our coaches. If you have an ego, you can't work on your football, because a lot of the outcomes are long-term based, so you're going to have to sacrifice some results, you're going to have to sacrifice some things that people might criticise you on, but that comes down to ego again. So my advice, and I speak about it a lot when I'm working maybe on a coach education course, if you have an ego, and we all have feelings, and we all have an ego to an extent where it's not nice to be criticised, whatever, but if you're going to work in elite development football, you have to park your ego.
And then when it comes to advising young players too, because they most certainly have egos, they're stepping out onto the pitch, they're expressing themselves, the match day experience can be the best thing, the worst thing, depending on what's happening in a particular game. How do you try and keep it all grounded and keep perspective in there especially with young people, when there's hormones and we're just all changing, thrown into the mix, and they're all just figuring out who they are as people, let alone as footballers. How do you keep a lid on it's the wrong word, but you understand where I'm going, hopefully.
Yeah, I think firstly, it's never pink and fluffy where we're saying don't win. We always make sure there's a goal, because human beings, players work with a goal, don't they? You need to have an outcome, a goal to work towards. So we'll always let them. So we'll say, for example, this first game, if we want to top the group, you know, we have to win this game. It's very important. And it sets the scene straight away. Now, in the background, we're still thinking about other things, but it's okay for them to want to win the game, because it's part and parcel of the game. But we talk quite a lot about processes. You know, you can't get too carried away. You want to score a goal. You can't just say, I'm going to score a goal. Can you get into this area of the pitch so many times? Here's how you do it. And then we talk quite a lot about humility. I get that a lot from if you read the New Zealand, the legacy book. I'm sure every coach in the world has read it. I've read it about four or five times. But it's so true, that humility, you know, your due diligence and your preparation. We use, you know, symbols and role models like Carl Frampton and Rory McIlroy and Aaron Hughes and you know, people who are from Northern Ireland who are world class, if you like. And we talk about their characteristics, and we talk about they're never afraid of where they come from. And so that's how we keep, you know, camp grounded. We use music. We'll use music by Snow Patrol. We'll keep everything Northern Irish and how proud we are to leave the shirt maybe in a better place. Again, go back to that All Blacks legacy book. And that's how we control emotion. We'll never... I mean, the pleasing thing for me is that if you take the 17s last week, they all knew what they wanted to win the game. They wanted to qualify. And we don't tell them not to. We just try and control it. Control the emotion aspect of it, and then when there is maybe a bad result, maybe we'll just paint the bigger picture, don't worry, or if it's a good result, we'll make them feel good, but bang, that's it over now, and tomorrow's a new day, and we roll the sleeves up again.
When you reflect on your playing career now with the knowledge that you have, and when you, because you must be thinking every now and again, little reminders of you when you were starting out, when you're working with young people and going, gosh, if I'd have done that, or I would have never done that, or whatever the case may be. How does that feel now, you know, looking at players who are starting that journey that you've now finished?
I think about it every day, actually. I think it's one of my biggest regrets, that I try and not let it eat me alive, that I came home from Scotland on a 3-year contract. I think psychologically I wasn't in a good place. I think I feared myself. I didn't trust myself. But I also didn't engage enough in the coaching process and listen to the coaches and realise that this is like you have to take on information here. And if I could, you know, if I could give a message to my 18-year-old self, I would say, listen, every day it's like everybody going to work. You can't have a good day every day, but you can learn and make yourself open to learn, which I didn't do. And that's why I'll try and use that as motivation. So if I'm explaining something to a midfielder, I'll try and ensure that even if they're not maybe enjoying the session, as long as they're taking a learning, I can give them one little piece of detail about the timing of your run or about if you're playing eight, you know, what your possession needs to be to actually affect play. So I'll give them some sort of learning. They can go, well, do you know what? At least he gave me something that it's made me a better player. And that's something I didn't have even domestically before I went to Scotland and Northern Ireland. I didn't really have a coach in my youth days who gave me any information about the game, how to play the game, I had to do everything, suppose like most people in our generation, off the cuff, figure it out. And again, it goes back to your question, learnings from my playing and my job now. That's why I want to make sure that we don't overcoach players, because the old street stuff is always the best way and the game is the teacher. But we do need some coaches who are in a position can actually empower young players and give them knowledge about the game. And that's what I'd like to do. That's what I'm trying to do at a certain stage, at a certain age, ensure the players are leaving our programme with much more educated on the game.
And it's that magic recipe that every single manager, coach, team wants to try and figure out. The instincts, you don't want to ever lose them, do you? Because that's the thing that makes you unique. That's the thing that makes you different. That's the thing that makes you unplayable. Mm-hmm. If you are just off the factory line, then you're never really going to be a top-tier talent, are you? And no one wants to iron that all out of players. But at the same time, you do want to give people the best resources, the most that they possibly can have, so that when they make a decision, it isn't just based on their own experience, but actually a greater understanding of the game and what's around them on the pitch.
That's a fair summary. I think that's how I felt. As a centre forward, you need to have that creativity. I don't think as a coach you can coach creativity. I think it's very important that you don't try and coach creativity, because it comes with instinct, it comes with your own, what you bring to the game.
So if a manager's telling you, Andy, where to make your runs,
yeah,
is that hampering your creativity? I mean, I'm picking on you as a player here.
Well, there's two things. I was a kinesthetic learner, so to some coaches they would say, oh, he's stupid, but I learned by feeling the game, and that's why I always try and make sure I'm covering all learning groups whenever I'm coaching. So I'm sure I was quite frustrating to coach, because people could be telling me stuff and I didn't do it. I didn't take it on board. But I also think, yeah, a lot of what I was good at, I was very instinctive. I was a runner. I played with, you know, tempo. Again, you can't coach that, but I should, to reflect on my own game, I should have been more open and listened. Because Tiernan Lynch, whenever he was assistant manager at Glentoran, gave me some very detailed instruction that had helped me ever since, in terms of my role as a nine and a three. So as a nine, you know, you're playing centrally, you have to take up good positions, you have to occupy centre halves. That information that he gave me was critical to develop me as a player. If I had got that information at a younger stage, it would have helped me. Now, how did he do it? His way was, he used a video of me in a game. I'm sitting watching myself going, oh my God, what am I thinking there? And that's when the penny dropped with me. So I think that is coaching. That is development coaching, is trying to not stifle creativity, not be a dictator and say you must do this. Enjoy the journey with players and take the rough with the smooth, but also can you give them little nuggets that it's going to help them in their position on the pitch and off the pitch?
When you start to think back of those important lessons that you learned throughout your playing days, can you pick out others from other managers or key moments that you think, you know, this is when I started kind of really backing myself? So Tiernan Lynch has given you an understanding of what it really means to be a striker and how you're going to be a good one. It clearly helps further set foundations for you to go on and have the career that you had. When you get to Linfield, what's that education like?
Yeah, great. I mean, if you take David Jeffrey signed me, he made me feel $1 million. He gave me a reason and a cause, because I knew I was making a move. I was going a life changing move, basically. But I felt very protected, I felt comfortable, I felt he believed in me. Warren Feeney came in, And Warren Feeney has this great way of making you again feel so good. He worked with me as a centre forward. He never took me off. He made me captain. And it was probably my most highest scoring season I ever had. I felt at all stages he bought into me, he backed me, he loved my style of play and he trusted me. And I remember walking into every game thinking that, you know, I'm going to score. And that was the strength. He was bubbly, he was energetic, he was fun to be around. David Healy comes in and David Healy set a clear precedent of what Linfield was about. We're going to win trophies. We haven't won trophies in a while and we're going to do it. And he set standards, he set accountability. He didn't want to be your friend. He made you understand that you're accountable to your position. If you're going to pull on the jersey to represent Linfield, you must win games, and that's just it. And again, each manager brought, like, and going back to little details, Healy worked quite a lot on centre forwards. I can hear myself coaching him, getting information off David Healy about nudge for the defender. Your first movement is always a nudge for the defender. And I can see Chris McKee now doing it. I can see Fitzy doing it. Mm-hmm. I've seen Shane Lavery doing it. So that was the information Healy used to want. Nudge for the defender, back in, get your body in, don't challenge for the header, body in. All those little streetwise things. And you learn bits and pieces off every manager. And that's coaching Sharon. It's taking a concept and then there's conceptualization, there's a feeling, and you take in what you think was good, what you think is bad, fits in with your intrinsic motivation and your beliefs. And I suppose every player does that, and I'm still doing it to this day. Like, I'm taking things off other coaches and how they make me feel. I'm taking things off, you know, even Patrick Nelson's my line manager at work. I'll take things off him about how he manages me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's learning, and you hope someday that young players will maybe take information off us and they might say, well, that little nugget that he gave me helped me in my career.
Would you say you were a confidence player?
Anybody who tells you otherwise is telling every player is a confidence player. I very much was. Emotional intelligence, somebody once coined the phrase that I had, but I just seen it as low self-esteem on the pitch. It's no coincidence if you're scoring goals, it seems everything runs for you. But I developed a thing, and I had a conversation with Stephen Laurie actually about it recently. He said that after a while, no matter how much you lost the ball or be criticised, you kept doing it, you kept going and going and going. I felt as a nine, in today's game, your job is to stretch the game to allow the better players to get on the ball, and your job is ultimately to put the ball in the net. So I feel as a centre forward, especially at Linfield, as I lost a lot of pace towards my latter years, you had to carry the can of the pressure of scoring a goal. And that might have meant don't touch the ball for a period of time, but knowing that comes a chance, you score, you get the headlines. And that's how I developed my confidence. And I was going right back to Tiernan Lynch's saying to me, he says, you're doing a lot of great things in the game, but if you want, because I wanted to play nine and they're playing me wide, he says, if you want to play nine, you've got to start scoring goals. So he says, do less around the box, do less here, do less there, but get in the box and score a goal then, and we'll play in nine.
Make it count.
So yeah, very much a confidence player, but I think after a while, once you develop your own skin and you realise what your role is, what your goal is, then it makes it a lot easier.
And the evolution of what a striker is, what a nine is, has been incredible too, really, hasn't it? You know, now, more or less, gone are the days of two up top, so lonely for strikers who are, no, I want someone to knock it down for me, please and thank you, or if you're the other role in that, I want someone to do all the chasing, and mm-hmm. I'll just do the bit at the end, if that's possible. You've got that. You've got how wingers have become inverted. Hold on, you're going to cut inside and you're going to
fullbacks
maybe...
Fullbacks are now inverted.
Fullbacks are inverted.
We actually did it out in our recent camp there. Yeah, we've found it. We've quite a lot of... Well, you look at, you know, the top... You take your information off the top level and you look at the FIFA and the UEFA technical reports. You look at the top managers, what they're doing, and you have to stand up and listen and read, and it's like school. So it makes more sense with your right and left back and coming out of possession to provide a sort of counter-pressing, but also when you're building up, if you have a really talented, technically good right back who can come in the pitch and build with you, then why not? And the game is changing. It's changing. It doesn't have to change for the good all the time. It's changing. You know, players might be as robust, whatever, but there's a lot of interchangeable hybrid players, they're calling them now. And look, I'm not one for... complicating the game. The fundamentals are still the same. Out of possession, you need to be resolute, robust, humble. In possession, you have to be creative and have that desire to score goals. So,
is there still room for an old-fashioned, big, bustling striker?
100%. When you need to have, you know, unless you're a top team whose plan A is so good that, you know, teams just can't deal with, which is, it's very seldom, very few about. Mm-hmm. You need to have, yeah, a plan B, a plan C, and there's a role for everyone. There's a role for absolutely every type of player, and you just need to find your team.
It's really interesting, the idea of being a striker, because I think people are lying if they don't say when you played football as a kid growing up, everyone wants to be the hero, everyone wants to be the goal scorer. Very few people think, I just hope I'm making the tackles. Not really. No, not for me. I was definitely never going to be a goal scorer as much as I might have tried in my younger years. But talking to different forwards down through the years, that change in the game, like Kevin Doyle, I spoke to a while ago, former Republic of Ireland international, and talking about, you know, once upon a time in his career in the Premier League, knowing I just get in the box, someone's going to whip across and I can stick my head on it. That changes and these crosses aren't coming anymore, so your runs need to change and your responsibility changes. You've even alluded to that yourself, as you know, through your Irish League career, that changed with different managers and styles. How difficult is it to make those changes, particularly when you're coming towards the end of your career and someone's now trying to tweak what you know?
Well, look, why are human beings like the longest species in this world? Because they can adapt the best, and you have to adapt. You can't. The aging process tells you that you can't be that. Whenever Shane Lavery came, he was what I felt me 10 years ago. He was the pace. So there was no point in me trying to challenge Shane Lavery for pace. So I had to make sure that I was central on the pitch. I had to make sure, something David Healy was good at with me, he worked on my short game. I had to make sure that my short game was better, that I could hold the ball up more, that I was still contributing to the team. Because at the end of the day, it's a team game. It's not about you. And my role was very much, so we had Kirk Millers, we had Joel Coopers, Stevie Fallons. I occupied, because I wanted them who were better on the ball than me, on the ball. So if I could take players away to get them on the ball, I was very comfortable with that. Some people aren't, and that's their prerogative. They'll maybe move on and go. I wanted to win. I loved being at Linfield. I still felt that I had a lot to do. I felt even off the pitch, and I was willing to do that. And I adapted my game. I became more of a, as David Healy would say, a 9.5, or a 9-ish, as he would often say to me, go and play 9-ish. And it was actually really, really good for me, because I learnt a lot about, even I use as a coach now, I remember playing European games where I played deeper and getting an extra midfielder, and I actually enjoyed it. So it depends what your motivation is. But if you want to stay at, in our context of the Irish League, which is Linfield, at the top, you had to make sure that you adapted and were still contributing to the team.
And there's a great point in there for players listening, and I know you're not standing up and patting yourself on the back and saying, be like me, I'm saying this. It can seem all rosy in the garden outside looking in, going, all the trophies, all the medals, all the great stories. There were probably plenty of occasions where you felt, they're trying to replace me, or I've fallen out of favour here, or why are they making me do this?
Every year, like Dave Healy tried to replace you every year, but he made no secret of it. Maybe that, at the time you're always angry, but maybe that's part of the success. Maybe that's what he was doing.
Repeat, just for me to let that sink in, repeat that.
Every year, yeah, the manager, David Healy, would have brought in another centre forward, or maybe another two centre forwards. But now I can see why. You have to. You have to go back to the legacy book. Once you're on top, you have to change. You especially at a club like Linfield, you cannot allow people to get comfortable. And he used a famous saying, he had coasters coast out. So if you were coasting and you felt you were coasting, you were gone. And I respect it more so because I'm now on the other side. But I knew with him, and I knew deep down he knew that I was never that person. I never would have coasted, but he couldn't have taken that chance because he was ultimately judged on the results. And but every year the boys just to keep me going, saying there's going to be two new centre forwards pre-season, and you'll start off the season on the bench, but then you just have to keep going. And it goes back to that desire. I had a desire. I wanted to stay there. I didn't want anybody to take my number 7 shirt. I always joke with Kirk Miller, you're the only person that will take my number 7 shirt. So I'm staying, and I'm going to make the decision when I leave. And that's what I did. There was times when I was on the bench, and maybe felt I should have been playing, but I just had to suck it up. Didn't accept it, but I had to suck it up and realise that there's a bigger picture here.
Who were the great people that, you know, if you're thinking like a bowling lane, you put the borders or the boundaries up so you don't go out of bounds. Certainly, if anyone's ever seen me bowl, occasionally I need it. Every other bowl, for some reason, I'm very inconsistent. Maybe need to work on that. Who are those people that kind of any time you were veering left or veering right on the alley, just boom, put you back in the middle again and, okay, right, heads back on, I can go and do this? And whether it be, you know, at a football club or just in life.
Yeah, look, my family. My mother, who since passed, was always one for my father. Great words of wisdom. They kept me really, really grounded. They always had a saying, there's always somebody better coming, you know, behind you, and you just have to realise that, and just, if you keep doing the right things, then, you know, even when no one else is looking, it'll work out okay. You just don't change what you're doing, keep working hard. I think at the club itself, Terry Hayes was always a good one for giving me advice. I mean, when I broke my leg on debut for Linfield, and Terry gave me the best rehab programme ever. And I come back and I scored a hat-trick on my league debut after being out for so long. And I put that down to Terry Hayes, his skill as a physio, but also his advice at the right time. If I was going through a sticky patch and maybe getting a rub, Terry would have said something that was cutting, but was really good. And I had a real good group of friends there. I know Michael Carville, I speak to quite a lot, Jimmy Callagher, you know, all people who wanted the best for you, knew that it was important for you to be at their club and kept you on the straight and narrow. You've actually used a good descriptive, I must use that now about the bowling lane, because I'm a big Alistair Campbell fan.
Yeah.
And I read quite a lot of his stuff, and he says that whenever Labour were going for the getting the number 10 for the first time, he was talking to Alex Ferguson, and Alex Ferguson had said that what you have to do is, because they were saying that we're not even in government yet and we're getting pulled everywhere, he says, just think of you jump over the last fence, you have your visors on and don't look left or right. I always used that. I always thought to myself, look, just get over the last hurdle, don't look left or right, just keep going. And that's why it's quite apparent that you used something similar.
It's just interesting how people frame things in their own lives, and we're all guilty of overcomplicating it, because maybe at times we think we've more choices than we do. You know, you think, if I do this or that, well, maybe that just wasn't an option. Maybe you're being too hard on yourself. You get a bit older, you get a bit more introspective, and you take time and start to realise, okay, well, control the controllables first. Someone told me control the controllables 10 years before I understood it, because I was just too young and impetuous.
Yeah, I still say it. Control what you can control. And you use it in football all the time. There's things going on outside, but what if they do this? You can't really control that. So it's easier said than done, but you can waste a lot of energy.
It's the old saying, comparison's the thief of joy. You're constantly going, why do they have that? Why are they doing that? Why can't... And you need to just isolate all the noise and nearly go, right, what can I do?
Mm-hmm.
And then you go from there. It was the growth mentality, isn't it, nearly, rather than the fixed mentality.
You're reading the same books as I am reading.
I think so. It's like, how do you kind of keep evolving? How do you keep building? And it's really, it's fascinating once you start to realise what your potential can be. In your career, I mean, we could do hours and hours and hours just talking about certain seasons nearly, but if we sort of skim through, what to you is the moment that you just go back to sometimes and think, you know what, it probably never got much better than that?
Probably the hat-trick at Solitude. And it's aligned to our previous point there. It got a stage where I was starting to doubt, because my first 3 years at Linfield, I was doing everything right. I didn't do anything. Like, I wasn't changing anything. I worked harder. I was basically a full-time footballer, even though I wasn't a full-time contract. Every single morning of my life was about, I need to win the league at Linfield. You think of all the greats that went before me, I'm letting them down. I can't leave this club without, you know, adding to their honours list. And that was that was my thought at the forefront of my mind. And it looked, you know, you look at that season, we were like 12 points behind with 13 games to go. And you're thinking, another season, I've given this everything. And then you crawl it back. Then you go two points up the last day of the season, and then you're 1-0 down at half time, and you're going, I've just, you know.
And meanwhile, I'm at Seaview. and Crusaders are turning it on against Glenavon, and it feels very much like there's only one way this afternoon's going.
Yeah.
And then.
I can remember, so as low as I was at half-time coming out, I remember thinking, like, this is do or die for me. Like, if I don't die, I'll never recover. And to have that feeling, you know, at full-time, I remember the Gibson Cup coming and being set there, and I'm saying, like, I can actually now, the red, white and blue ribbons will be on this, I can actually now say that I've contributed to this club, to this reason why I came here, and it was just the best feeling, and it would be hard. And then obviously I scored the three the week after, so it would be from thinking it's all going to be taken from you to actually doubling up was.
Isn't there a story there as well about those two hat tricks? Wasn't there like a little challenge set to you?
David Healy, he says I'm expecting 30 before the last game of the season. He says, like, how many have you got this year? And I'd said, well, 24, and he says, I'm expecting 30. I was expecting 30 goals this season. He says, to be an infield centre forward, you need to be hitting around the 30 mark. So we joked, and he says, well, there's two more games to go, and it obviously happened. So
he'll take the credit for that.
Well, he'll say, look, you got your 30, and he was a hard man to please. I remember one day he dropped me, I scored a hat trick on the Tuesday night, and he dropped me. We played Warren Point on the Friday, and I says, I'm dropped. And he says, yeah, you're dropped. That's the way it has to be. I said, but I scored three on Tuesday, and he says, yeah, but two of them were penalties, so it's not a real hat trick. So he was a hard man to please.
And probably somewhere in the back of his head, he was thinking, I can rest you here, but also motivate you that when I really need you to perform in the next game. But there's no good telling you that. Did this have to light a wee fire every once in a while in certain players?
Yeah. He created that siege mentality where he made you believe that everybody into a person who hated Linfield. And you ended up hitting that person, and you actually meet the person. Like, it's really nice. So that's how he managed, and he created that siege mentality amongst us. I think he wanted us to not like him. He wanted us to be like, well, I need to show him. I need to prove him wrong. He had a real great way of doing that.
He's such an interesting person. I've got to know him pretty well. Obviously, you've played under him. Misunderstood, maybe. Well, quite probably by a lot of people, because they see him in post-match interviews, which is a very tiny part of his personality, really. Quite mischievous. I have a lot of time for him. I really like being in David's company. But I would imagine, you know, as you say, ruthless and sometimes difficult to play under, but ultimately very successful.
Yeah, and he makes no bones about it. Very humble, from what he's achieved. He still goes back to his roots. We still have conversations about my local team's Kilmore Rec, his is Kilday. Mm-hmm. He always have time for you. He doesn't want to lead the flash life. He doesn't want the public life. He's
it actually embarrasses him, doesn't it? He's, you know, all that sort of any fanfare. It's nearly like he's like allergic to it.
Yeah, he knows he probably has to do it, but it's not him. Very easy to talk to, but very well respected within the change room. The boys all a little bit of fear, which is what you need, and. One thing he really tries to portray, which is what he's about, is success at Linfield, and he also has that emotional connection to it because he supported Linfield, and he made sure that there was success with it, and he it's not that he didn't care how he achieved it, he was willing to do whatever he needed to do to achieve success.
So many managers, successful managers, nearly put their own personality into the team, don't they? And you think of his career, where at early stages he was overlooked, people thought he was too small to be a good goal scorer, how wrong they were. That chip on his shoulder, I'm going to prove everybody wrong, it doesn't matter what you think, I can do it myself. Just fiercely motivated from within. Mm-hmm. And then he finds a way to project that onto an entire team.
Yeah, look, I wouldn't like to be in a position where I'm speaking for David, because I can't. I haven't lived his career as one of his players. That's it. He had that. You could tell that intrinsic motivation to he thrived on it. He nearly looked, I think, every day for something in the media that he could use to. And I think he got that from the generations of the David Jeffries and stuff at Linfield too. But that's what he felt he needed, and maybe that came from within, from him, from his playing days, from the little lad, you know, from Northern Ireland going in England. And that's what he used. He used it. He made sure that we used that as motivation. And as I say, every team talk, he maybe had somebody had said something, and he used it to say that they are disrespecting Linfield, or they're doubting you and challenging you, and that certainly motivated us. And, you know, he ruled that way.
It's just, to me, something that I am always really intrigued by, people's personalities and how that can impact things, because I'm sure you've played with, and now you're coaching footballers that just come in with that swagger, and it's like, oh, this is what I do, and you think, God, I'd love to be that way.
Yeah.
I'd love to not worry so much.
Look, there's people who don't worry as much and are a little bit more laid back, there's no doubt, but we're all human beings and we all have emotions, we all doubt ourselves at times, we work quite a lot, confidence is very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
I think the higher performers are able to work on it more, to keep it, their confidence for longer periods of time. But that's also where a good manager comes from, where you're able to, and like, you can talk tactics all you want, but still human beings who play the game, and you need people who are confident. Like, you can even see the difference in a young player who's confident and some player who's lost their confidence, and I think you have to be really acutely aware of that. And that's just like, you see the people who come in sometimes and betray this real confident image, but maybe deep down they're not.
Mm.
But like, it takes all sorts, and that's the beauty of sport, I think, in general. I think that's the psychology of sport that we all love, that we're all invested in, is the whole confidence and the achievement on the real high levels. Like, I watched the rugby was fascinating.
Oh yeah.
Like you just see how strong mentally, you know, certain individuals are. And
South Africa just winning by the odd point here or there the whole way through against the best teams.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm a big tennis fan. I watched Djokovic. I watched him recently there in the final, and after, you know, losing to Wimbledon. And some of these guys are incredible. I'm sure they work really, really hard at their confidence, but they have that probably motivation of winning, of that mentality of just getting better. And, you know, I'm sure it's very tiring.
But somebody had said, one of the podcasts I was watching on a very long and even more delayed flight back, I sat in the runway for 4 hours before I took off. I was in great form. But I tried to use that time constructively. And they were saying about, you know, part of your emotional intelligence when you're competing, going on to whatever it is, in this case a football pitch, and believing I need to be the best I can be rather than I have to win, sometimes can be a better mindset, because you're just, it's that control and controllables. Don't let what's going on around you stop you doing from what you need to do and be the component that you need to be. Whereas if you're worried about solely the result, then things that are out of your control are now impacting your own performance. I don't know how true that is, but it made me think of the amount of times doing different things where I thought, it has to be the best, I have to win, I have to do this. And it doesn't always have the right outcome.
Yeah, it's focus, but then too much focus isn't good either. You maybe lose track of what's important, and you might miss some things in your performance or in your preparation that you've been so consumed by something else. So I don't think too much. And I'm not speaking as an expert. I can only, you know, relive my feelings, because I'm not a psychologist. But I think there is something in there to say that too much focus can't be good for you.
Now, in closing, only a couple of minutes left, but the league where the Sports Direct Premiership, to give it its proper branding, is at the moment, feels really exciting. You've got full-time teams moving towards that. Person, you know, running the league, and Jared Lawler, who's saying he wants to see the league grow and grow and grow, and they've got this vision for where it can get to. I'm sure selfishly you're thinking, well, it'd be wonderful if there's lots of full-time teams, full-time academies, all the best players being nurtured here, and you can cherry pick them for your side. What's realistic? What would you like to see in the, I don't know, the next 3, 5, 10 years here in Northern Ireland, for us to have as much success as possible?
Yeah, look, I'm probably speaking more so as a fan now. As a football fan, as somebody who's invested in the game every day, I would like to see a full-time model. Now, I respect those clubs who say, look, it's not possible. I'd prefer not to change if we're going to be reckless. But I don't think I'm giving credit here, I don't think our clubs are reckless. I respect the new strategy NIFL have. I actually think it's good. Where the league wants to go, I would like to see one of our teams qualify for Europa League group stages. I would, and there's no doubt about it. I suppose in my position, it's my opinion, and personally, I would like to see an academy structure. I think that there needs to be a pathway for a system for aspiring young players here who want to remain in Northern Ireland. I don't think it will be done overnight. I think we have to be really diligent and careful how we do it. But I think why not? Why not have a full-time game here? It doesn't mean to say we have to do it tomorrow. But like, I mean, even yourself, Michael, we've now got, you know, a full-time media outlet wrapped around the game. We have a lot of corporate sponsors who are invested in the game. We have, you know, everything is geared towards a thriving professional game in Northern Ireland. And I'm no different as a fan. That's what I want to see. You want to see attendance, you know, figures going up. I want to be able to go to a game and feel like I'm at a professional football game, whether it's Glenavon against Cliftonville or whoever it is. And then subsequently, and with that comes probably my job then, where you have players who are playing at a better level, getting more contact time, getting more coaching hours, and just for those players who don't maybe make it into the full-time game or want to go there, at least there is a place here for them.
We've already started to see it, haven't we? It strengthens the championship, mm-hmm. strengthens presently the bottom half of the Premiership and the championship, the players that can't do full-time. So the big challenge will be if there is a calendar shift, which feels like it is coming.
Yeah, do you know what? I don't think full time is the secret word here. I think it's more mentality. I think the full time will come in time. You can't. And I have sympathy. I wouldn't want to be a chairman of a club or a board of a club at the minute, because it is tough, because you have to stay with the pack, but also you have to manage expectation. It's a very tough thing to do. But I think it's the mentality. It hurts me for people to think they use, it's just, oh, it's just Irish League. And I know we have a little bit of banter and Irish League behaviour and stuff, but that I don't like that. I think that we play ourselves down. We have a good league, we have a good product, we have good people around it. And once we break into European group stages, I'm hoping that will be the shift. How do we do it? By just having that mentality, a more professional mentality. And you see clubs already doing it. They're employing full-time analysts. They're making coaches and youth team coaches full-time now, so it's an actual business. And we upscale the business, and that's only good for Northern Ireland football, and that's what we need. That's what the other nations have. So that's, I just don't want people to think I'm saying you go full time and that's the answer. It's the mentality shift, and I'm sure then supporters will want to go and not lose their identity of being where they're from, but having a better product then on the pitch.
There's a lot of work to do, and what's clearly come across here is that it never stops.
It never stops. It doesn't. It doesn't stop.
It never stops. And next up for you is?
I travel tomorrow to Wales, so our under-16s will complete in the Victory Shield. So we'll support Chris in that. A lot of the players who were under-17s, so six of them will now, so they have the same as myself, they have a day's rest and they travel to Wales to compete. And like, we'll go there and it's another development opportunity. It's another time for exposure for our young players of international football. And the missus give me a hard time, but I'll get a good night's sleep tonight, hopefully, and look forward to the challenge of the week ahead.
I'm incredibly jealous of all those players and just how much fun they're having at the moment. It does sound brilliant.
I know. I'm jealous myself. I wish I was back to being a player.
There you go, everybody. Any players listening, food for thought. Enjoy it whilst you can. It's been really lovely having you on, Andy. Really, really great to catch up. Thanks so much for coming on to The Score.
Look, it's a pleasure, and I'm glad I'm able to come. My busy schedule, I'm glad I'm able
to fit you in, Hollywood.
To come in, and do you know what? It's been therapeutic for me too, because you've made me reflect on quite a lot of things that I'm doing, and it's been nice to relive the memories. And look, best wishes the rest of the year.
The Score with Michael Clark.
Well, that brings us to the end of this week's show. Thank you so much for your company, as always. And remember, you can keep in touch with all the things we do wherever you get your podcasts from. Just search for The Score NI. But for now, all that remains to be said is enjoy your weekend of sport. Bye-bye.